John Merrow has been covering education for more than 35 years, first as a reporter for NPR and now as a correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. In his latest book, The Influence of Teachers, Merrow tackles many of today's hot-button issues, from teacher tenure to charter schools to controversial leaders such as Michelle Rhee and Paul Vallis. Along the way, he leavens his observations with humor, wit, and wisdom from his own personal experience as a teacher. Today we talk with John about his book and what he's learned from the countless hours he's spent as a reporter in America's classrooms. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. John Merrow, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, Mike.
All right, John. So we're talking about your latest book, The Influence of Teachers. I'm curious, why did you decide to write this book, and who were you writing it for? What's the intended audience?
I decided to write the book. I was fussing with an earlier book and kind of locked myself in a room and wrote, and it wasn't very good. And my board chair, Esther Wojcicki, who's a brilliant high school journalism teacher, said, John, imagine if you got hit by a bus and that book was mentioned in your obituary. Would you want to go out that way? You have a good book in you. Some of it's in that book, but you have a better book inside you. Go write it. Hmm. And this time I took her advice. And this time I worked with three colleagues in my office. I would send them the material and they'd say, no, 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 or yes, yes, yes. A couple of good friends who read things and were wonderful critics. So that's how it happened. I didn't want that previous book to be the last thing I ever did. I haven't been hit by a bus yet so far. But who is it for? It's not a wonky book. It is an attempt to be storytelling, but also about some important issues. So I hope it's for anyone who cares about the future of the country. I know that's a pretty big group. But there's some, you know, a public education is a foundation of this democracy, and it's not a very healthy system right now. There are great healthy spots, or wonderful schools, or good things happening, but I'm concerned that there's this, what amounts to a, it's not a shooting war, but amounts to a war on teachers, and that at the end of the day, it doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, good. I look forward to talking about that war for sure. Let me ask you a couple of questions, though, first about, again, your experience as a writer, because this is really interesting. So what was it about that other book that was different from this book? I mean, as a writer, what did you need to do to get this to where you wanted it to be?
It was one of the Restoration playwrights who said that easy writing makes cursed hard reading. And writing is hard work, but it is not something that one can do in isolation. You have to test it. Have other people read it and say, I don't understand what you're trying to say. I wanted to write very specifically about the role of teachers and then leaders as well. And so that's easier if you have a smaller target, in effect. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to go back to the stories I've been privileged to cover for the NewsHour and say, let me reflect on what I learned 3 years ago or 5 years ago or last week and write about that. So in that sense, I gave myself an easier task. But more importantly, what I did was I vowed I would not try to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Now, in the book, you offer a lot of your own opinions on all kinds of hot button issues, and yet your day job is as a journalist. Is this a problem? Is it hard to figure out how to walk that line? You know, are you an opinion leader or are you a journalist?
Well, I'm not an opinion leader. A number of people who reviewed the book have said that I have not gone out of my way to put my own opinions in the front. You can read through and hear lots of different views. Sooner or later, you figure out where I stand. For example, this battle now between people who say we need better people and those who say, well, we need to make teaching a better job. It's not until the last chapter of the book that you know where I stand. So I think of myself as a reporter. I do feel strongly. I get to say things in my blog every week that I feel strongly about. But I do think of myself primarily as a reporter. I hope this book doesn't jeopardize my standing in the trade.
Right. No, I don't think it will. All right. So let's talk about the war. You just described it as a war on teachers, not a shooting war, but still a war on teachers. In the book, you talk about sort of this eclectic group of reformers on one side and the unions on the other. So first of all, I'm curious again about your own position. I mean, do you see yourself as part of either of those camps? Do you agree with them on some things and disagree on others?
You know, what is it? Some of my friends say this and some of my friends say that, and I agree with my friends. What I depict in the book that the people in what I call the Better People Camp, the members of the Better People Army, are much more powerful. They include Michelle Rhee and Joel Klein and Teach for America, the charter school movement. And we call a lot of hedge fund folks. There's a huge, and a couple of documentaries, a deeply flawed one called Waiting for Superman, another called The Lottery, sort of pushing this argument that the education, public schools problem is we don't have enough good people. And if you only had more good people, things would take care of themselves. On the other side, a much weaker army, sort of Diane Ravitch with a megaphone, is saying, no, wait a sec, we need to make teaching a better job. Teaching is filled with daily humiliations. The world is full of former teachers. And if you made teaching a better job, many of the problems we have in school would go away. My argument in the book, Mike, is that while it's a fascinating, lively battle going on, it is fundamentally irrelevant to the needs of our kids. And I would put it to you this way. You know, there are three reasons we send our children to school, three reasons you went to school. The reasons you went, you're over the age of 27, the three reasons you went to school, only one of those applies today. You went to school because that's where they kept the knowledge. It was in the textbooks, it was in the teacher's head, it was in the encyclopedias. That's just not true today. Today it's 24/7. We're surrounded by information. But schools remain these answer factories when they should be places that help kids formulate questions, that help kids separate the wheat from the chaff. And since we want them to choose the wheat, that means we are teaching values. We should acknowledge that. The second reason you were sent to school, I went to school, was for socializing. You got to learn to get along with that Italian kid or that Spanish kid or that WASPy kid or that boy or that girl, whatever. Well, you know, today there's an app for that. Hundreds of apps that are social. Our kids are like, it's like pen pals on steroids. But schools have to change there as well, because our 14-year-olds socializing like mad with other 40, or people they think are 14-year-old, but in fact they could be a 40-year-old congressman trolling. So that schools need to recognize the power of technology, help kids understand that when they put something up there, it's forever. And the third reason is custodial care. You were sent there because your parents were working. They needed to keep you off the streets and safe. Same for me. That's still true today. But if schools haven't changed in the first two ways, if they're really just custodial care and the kind of marginal education, they become dangerous places for an awful lot of children. I mean, our kids are smart. They're energetic. They will use that energy and intelligence negatively if we don't use it positively. Mm-hmm. That's happening. We have cyberbullying and so on and so forth. So as the argument is the influence of teachers is that the better people, better job argument is interesting, but we need to make some transformational changes to schools. And I'm trying to show how in the book.
Mm-hmm. And so what the technology, online learning, all of the information age, that all of that makes these other debates less important? I mean, it still matters who the teacher is, right?
Of course it does. The teacher, inside the school, the teacher is absolutely the most significant factor. We all know that. There's plenty of data that shows that. What we need to do is, you mentioned technology. I mean, I wrote a piece about, it's not in the book, but about, I was the way technology can be used, you still can keep kids in the building, but the technology doesn't respect the walls. So I suggested that, for example, you know, Texas has 4,000 miles of fast running water. I'm not talking about the Rio Grande and that sort of turtle, no water, but 4,000 miles. Seems to me that science classes in Texas, kids ought to be going to the water, going to the water's edge and sampling that water, measuring it, analyzing it for acidity, alkalinity, the speed at which it's flowing, the detritus. Then they ought to share that data with kids all across the state, analyze it, where they find anomalies, try to figure out why. I mean, that's real work. That's not regurgitation. That's creating stuff. You can do the same thing in the city. I live in Manhattan. On my intersection, there's a trash can on every corner, a large public trash receptacle. I was in the South Bronx of a school, and I noticed on one corner, there was one garbage can on the four corners, just one, for the four corners. That street was dirtier. Now, why not a middle school class map, take their phone, their camera, and just take pictures of the intersection. Start sharing the data. I mean, these are, in effect, cleanliness opportunities. Mm-hmm. Are those resources fairly evenly distributed? If not, why? How are they? I mean, that's real work. Mm-hmm. It makes school a lot more interesting, and it's using technology. It's challenging kids to discover stuff, which is what we need.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write as a former teacher. You're one of those, you say the world is full of former teachers. You're one of them, a brief stint back in the 1960s. Tell us, what was Mr. Marrow like as a teacher?
Oh, wow. I in the book, the lead chapter is called The Influence of Teachers, and it's a story of my being invited back to the 40th reunion of my kids, who at that point, were, you know, 57 and I was 60 or 61, and they still called me Mr. Marrow. And they told me all kinds of stories and about how, the kids' lives I messed up didn't come and tell me. So it's a select sample, so it may not be an accurate picture of me as a teacher. I mean, but they told me stuff that I had done that influenced, that changed their lives. And all I was doing as a teacher, I was not trained as a teacher. I was going into the Peace Corps, and then I tore my back and couldn't go and ended up teaching in New York. But so I was just copying a terrific teacher I had had in high school. I tried to do the stuff he did, but I was just struck because I knew how he had influenced me. And then when these kids, these 57-year-old former students of mine, told me things that I had done which had no memory of, but how it influenced their decision to be a lawyer or to be a writer. I was just blown away, Mike, by the impact I had had. And then you just magnify that. We have 3.2 million teachers in this country. Each of those teachers, I'm sure, went into this profession to make a difference, to do good work. And each of them has changed lives. If we figure out a way to maximize those opportunities, to have more people aware of that, to feed it back. I mean, I'm lucky because I'm on television. I hear from former students, but most teachers, I suspect, don't ever hear from the kid whose life they changed. So part of what I would hope is see, write your teacher. But you said, what was I like? I don't have any memory of this, but apparently I said to the boys, you know, the graffiti in the boys' room is really awful. Let's put up poetry instead. And for some reason, they decided to do that. I remember being so desperate to try to hold the kids' attention that I had them reading Renaissance by Ignace Vincent Millay. Said, is there some way to present this instead of just reading poetry? And some kids said, yeah, let's set it to music. And suddenly we had a jazz trio in the composed, original music, but reading. I mean, so I was lucky. I wasn't bound by the rules of No Child Left Behind or this intense pressure to get kids over the bar and the bubble test stuff. I was told, well, your kids have to read two plays or three plays. They have to read Macbeth. But nobody told me how to teach it or how long to spend on it. So I put Macbeth on trial. and Lady Macbeth for first degree murder, and had kids playing the parts and all that stuff, because I had the flexibility, I had the trust. That's one of the things we have lost. We have lost the trust, which again is why one of the reasons I wrote this book.
Yeah, I almost can picture Robin Williams playing you in a movie, John.
No, I don't think I was that. He did that wonderful Dead Poets Society. You know, I was not. But I was lucky. I had a department chair who encouraged us, a couple of other young teachers. We could share stories and swap ideas. There's a wonderful journal called the English National Council of Teachers of English put out a journal. I would steal ideas. But again, I had a system which, although it was a rigidly tracked high school, Mike, I mean, there were five tracks, and they didn't let a new teacher like me anywhere near the ones or the twos. I was given threes and fours, and they didn't, you know. So
the ones being the most advanced students.
And of course, you know what you are. Schools are still tracked, they're not as formally or as rigidly, but in a sense, because the threes and the fours weren't as important to the system, we had some freedom to do a lot of interesting stuff. And as I say, we had some trust. Mm-hmm. That matters a great deal.
So that is a theme that runs through the book. And you mentioned this earlier, this sense that there's a war on teachers, that we've gone off course. And yet, you know, the people from the reform crowd would say, look, what we've had in the past was what needed changing. I mean, do you think that we have, we're in worse shape today than we were when you were a teacher 35 years ago?
It's a mixed bag. In some ways, we're worse because of the restrictions of this kind of stock market quarterly reports. Let's see what those bubble tests show. In other ways, we're better off. No Child Left Behind was a great contribution in that it essentially said you have to, quote, disaggregate the data. You've got to tell us how each group is doing. You can't hide behind the high scores of one particular group. So, the memorable phrase, the soft bigotry of low expectations, is a real contribution. And in that sense, we're better off. We're paying much more attention. On the other hand, because of this obsession with bubble tests and this bar, we've lost programs for gifted kids. And the pressure to get kids over the bar, as you know, has led to some cheating scandals and apparent scandals that are still being worked through. But it's also led to a loss of programs for gifted kids. Now, that really matters, Mike, because talent is randomly distributed. It doesn't matter how rich your parents are or even how well-educated your parents are. That gift occurs randomly. But if your parents are the kinds who take you to the museums and have make sure you have piano lessons and have long conversations at dinner, you're getting that stimulation at home. But there are an equal number of kids who don't have that kind of parent. So their stimulation has been at school. If you take away those gifted programs, the school ones, the kids who have the first group of parents, they're still getting it at home. That's fine. They'll stay up there. But the ones who don't get it at school, they, in fact, regress toward the mean. Bill Sanders down in North Carolina has some data which indicates that. That is what's happening. So that notion that full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air, and Gray's adage written in the country church, we cannot afford that. We cannot afford to waste sweetness on the desert air. We need to nurture talent wherever we find it. And public school is a place to do that.
Okay, we're here talking with John Merrow about his book, The Influence of Teachers. When we return, we're going to tackle some of the big issues in teacher quality policy, such as teacher tenure, Teach for America, and more. Again, you're listening to the Education Next Book Club.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Okay, we're back with John Merrow, the author of The Influence of Teachers, Reflections on Teaching and Leadership. John, thanks again for joining us. Let's talk some about Teach for America. You write in the book that you have spent a lot of time in the classrooms of Teach for America teachers. What's your take on that program?
I'm a a fan, but I think I'm a two cheers, not three cheers. You know, the fact that we have Teach for America says volumes about teaching as a profession. As I write in the book, you cannot imagine Nurse for America, but we can imagine Teach for America. When we were following Paul Vallis in New Orleans for the NewsHour, we've ended up following seven Teach for America volunteers. And then I had this great material and wanted to make a documentary about it. No one would touch it because the people wanted it to be all good. And it's not. It's like life. You know, it's not all good. Some of the young men and women who come into Teach for America are terrific. Some are not. What we found in New Orleans was there wasn't a strong enough support system for the ones who were struggling. And we ended up profiling all seven. You could see them on our website, learningmatters.tv. One of the things I admire tremendously about Teach for America is that they, what is it called, walking back the cat, or go tracing back to find out what worked, what didn't work, and the way they train those volunteers, in the way they admit people to the program. But they want to know, and if the 1,300 places around the country that train teachers could follow Teach for America just in that one level, the system would improve tremendously. I mean, right now, the last data that I have is from 2007. We hired 200,000 first-year teachers. 30% of them came from alternative certification programs. Now, that's 60,000 teachers who came in not through traditional teacher training. Teach for America only contributes about 4,000 of them. But if everyone would say, let's do what TFA does and look carefully at how we admit people and how we train them and whether they work, the system would be a lot better.
You also take up the big issue of teacher evaluation. You describe how for decades that system has been a joke, and now there are efforts underfoot to change it. Do you see any of these efforts as particularly promising?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think they have to get a lot better. Michelle Rhee is a controversial person, the former chancellor in Washington, D.C. She was able to impose a system called IMPACT. Now, what it was replacing, as you said, Mike, essentially a joke. Someone sits in the back of the room, checks off a few things, and says, great. And 96, 95, 98, whatever it was, percent of teachers are rated satisfactory. It's a wonderful report called the Widget Effect, which demonstrates, which documents that. Clearly that you can't have, say, 95% of our teachers are doing just fine when you have performance rates by kids, which are abysmal in many places. Michelle's system said, no, every teacher will be evaluated five times, three times by someone in the school, two times by outside people. That has some flaws, I know, but it is a damn sight better than what it is replacing. I tend to think there have to be better ways, but I do know the pressure is on to connect teaching and learning. Now, I did a documentary back in Philadelphia when I followed David Hornbeck, and there the union guy says on camera, there's no relationship between teaching and learning. You cannot hold a teacher accountable for whether kids are learning. Well, that's like the swimming coach saying, I taught them to swim. I'm sorry, 30% of them drowned. It's not my fault. I taught them to swim. I mean, those days are over. Teacher unions now are willing to connect the dots, in part because of charter schools. And when kids go to charter schools and teachers go to charter schools, they don't have to belong to a union. So the teacher unions in Washington, D.C. is a good example, are saying we have to fight to make our traditional public schools appealing to the public. And the only way we can do that is to admit that what we do influences learning. So there's some progress being made.
Well, I'm curious what your take is on the Gates Foundation-funded effort to use videotaping as a part of teacher evaluation. I'm not sure if you got into that in the book, but this says, hey, if the principal can't evaluate teachers too often because they are busy and have other things to do, why not have a video camera in the classroom and then have other experts grade teachers more frequently?
The kindest word is boondoggle. Mike, I've been doing television now since 1982. And in those years, I have now an archive of 90,000 hours of hire a professional video, 90,000 hours since 1982. The Gates Foundation project is going to produce, I think, 70,000 hours of video in just this first year alone. What they're doing is, you know, putting a camera in the back of the room, putting a mic on the teacher. What I'm told is that it totally depends on what happens with the AV guy, whether they care enough to set it up properly. Someone's going to sit and watch that. It's going to be a little cottage industry for retired superintendents. You know, if you really want to use video, a far more promising approach than just putting a camera in the back of the room and letting it shoot whatever happens is to do it professionally. Do it with the really best teachers. Here's what I would do. I would, you know, let's say you're the really good teacher and I want to do a short unit on how Mike Petrelli does a classroom discussion. I would videotape you, and what you'd see is how you're maybe in the front of the room, moving around the front of the room, and you get an answer from Carlos. Now, a not very experienced teacher might keep the conversation going with Carlos, but a good teacher, an experienced teacher, would say, turn to someone older in the other side of the room who hasn't been participating and say, Nancy, what do you think of what Carlos said? And then and pull a response out of her and go back to someone else. Now, the way you videotape that would be kind of fun. In the back of the room, you're seeing you gesturing over here, gesturing over here. What I would do is I'd show you in the front of the room having this, and then I'd have fun with it. I'd go to slow-mo. I'd use a kind of John Madden telestrator and say, Watch what Mike is doing. And in slow-mo, see you pointing over here. And then underneath that, I would have an audio interview with you explaining what you do to have a good classroom discussion. The teacher watching that would say, hey, I could do that.
Yeah.
But you'd have to do it in discrete units.
Right.
So it's 5 or 6 minutes, and then you put it up on the web where good teachers who want to know how to do this, how to do that, and they would see samples of that. But just to put someone in a camera in the back of the room, see, they're thinking about it as a way to evaluate teachers. That should what our focus should be on improving teachers and what they do.
Yeah.
You can then figure out how you're going to evaluate whether, in fact, John, who watched Mike do the classroom discussion, whether John learned from it. But what you need is you have to create opportunities for people to be good at their profession.
Right.
That's what I would do. I think it's Gates has done some good things. This, I don't think, is one of them.
Okay. That's very interesting. Let's talk about also seniority. It's very interesting. I mean, you in the book, you certainly explain the problems with seniority and tenure, but in the end, you say that you wouldn't start by getting rid of seniority protections. Why is that?
I would not start by getting rid. No, I think that it's too easy for that to be abused. And I've been in too many schools, Mike, where teachers are told, you're an English teacher, and they say, John, you're going to teach history and math this year, where there's not a serious protection. I would get rid of tenure. I would say, you could have 5-year contracts. If you have due process protections, you don't need tenure. And even Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, is stopping using that word tenure. Seniority is a different thing. I think you have to create protection so that people are not just pushed around, so they're not let go because they're more expensive. Now, New York City has I can't remember the term, where it is a school budget, and you have to create incentives for principals to keep their best teachers, regardless of how many years they've been on the job. You can't have seniority be the sole factor, but I just don't think you'd get rid of it automatically.
Now, that's related to this issue of the single salary schedule. I mean, the reason that those more experienced teachers are more expensive is because right now we have a system where you get paid more the longer you hang in there.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense at all. Some kinds of teachers are harder to get. Some schools are harder to staff. There ought to be recognition of that. I argue in the book, the old way of paying teachers is dead. Schools of education have lived off it for a long time, and they should recognize that they better get out in front of it. I mean, teachers getting paid for every extra course they take, that's dying, and it should die. me, I like the idea of a school as an intentional community. If you base the pay, everyone's pay, on how well the kids do on the areas that are tested, then the school secretary has a vested interest in making the call when you don't show up for school, calling your home. I mean, you want this rising tide to lift all boats, but you don't want to do it by testing across the curriculum. You figure out, okay, you want to test in English language arts, they call it, and math, that's fine. So you want to give the music teacher an interest in making sure kids understand the mathematical aspects of music. To me, that makes much more sense.
Okay, well, we're here talking with John Merrow, the author of The Influence of Teachers. When we come back, we're going to talk about Michelle Rhee and Paul Vallis. John spent a lot of time with those two important leaders, and we're going to hear about it. You're listening to the Education Next Book Club.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Okay, we're back with John Merrow. So, John, you spent a lot of time in the last couple of years with Michelle Rhee and Paul Vallis, did long series for NewsHour. How many segments did you do on each of those leaders for the NewsHour?
We did 6, 4, and 2, 12 about each one. We did 6 the first year, 4 the second year, 2 the third year.
Okay.
It was fascinating work in both places.
Yeah. All right, so tell us about that. How did you decide to do that, and how did you get them to agree to be followed around?
I do write about this in the book, that when they were both chosen at about the same time. I did not know Michelle Rhee. I knew Paul from Chicago and Philadelphia. I thought, wouldn't it be great to follow one of them? I thought, well, why don't I ask both, because there's no way both will say yes. I called up Michelle Rhee, introduced myself. She said, well, I have to think about it. I'll only do it if I think it's good for children. Let's have dinner. So I said, great. Okay. So I went down to Washington, had dinner with my producer at the NewsHour, and I had dinner with Michelle, and we talked about it. Same time, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to hedge my bets and call Vallis. Michelle left that dinner saying, I'll think about it, I'll tell you tomorrow. I called Vallis thinking he'd do the same thing. Paul said, sure, come on down, whatever you want. I'll give you full access. Great, got Paul Vallis. Michelle calls the next morning and said, I've decided to do it. Great. But unfortunately, I didn't have the money to do both. But you couldn't say, well, I didn't want to choose one or the other. They're both great stories. And if you miss opening day, you're gone. So I decided I would gamble, and we shot opening day for both of them. And then I went scrounging, and luckily some foundations, the Wallace Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation. I went to these 5 foundations, all of which helped out, and we started off covering them. It was a fascinating experience. Two of the worst school systems in the country, both of which made strides. The continuing controversy in both places. Vallis was determined to drive a stake through the heart of the old Orleans Parish School Board and create a system of schools, not a school system. And now I think 70% of the schools are chartered schools. And we're putting together a documentary right now about that. That's a national experiment that may be repeated again, but how this turns out is quite remarkable. And the schools have gotten better. The kids are doing better. And you have to remember, New Orleans is a long history of failure. Anybody in New Orleans who could afford to avoid the public schools did. And so Vallis, as he says, well, we're now at the base camp. We're nowhere near even climbing Everest, but at least this year we're at the base camp. As for Michelle Rhee, she is a dominant personality, and she may have said some things in interviews that she came to regret. I mean, she let us film her firing someone. She posed for Time magazine, that very controversial picture with the broom. She alienated a lot of teachers. On the NAEP scores, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which Checker Finn, of course, was one of the architects of, the kids in D.C. did better. than kids in any other city, in both fourth grade and eighth grade. On the other hand, there's a real backlash. There's some allegations of administrator cheating that seem to be very serious. Are the schools better? The more kids go to charter schools, that's in most cases, that's a healthy thing. The enrollment has stable, the decline has stabilized, in fact, went up this year. So on balance, you know, Michelle Rhee accomplished some remarkable things. She made it impossible to have a conversation about paying teachers that doesn't talk about student performance. I mean, I give her full credit for changing the national conversation there. It's a fascinating chapter in the book, actually, and especially in the notes, with some of the background stuff in the notes, that it was a treat for me.
Mm-hmm. And what you spent a lot of time with these two leaders. I'm just curious what you think about their various styles. I mean, would you put your money on the Paul Vallis style and approach or the Michelle Rhee style and approach? How are they similar? How are they different?
Well, Vallis strikes me as a guy who would throw ideas at the wall and hope that some of them stick and choose the ones that stick. Michelle is much more focused. I know what we're supposed to do, and we're going to do this, and don't get in my way. A number of people have said, John, you should have been covering this person and that person. And they'll point to, say, someone like Andres Alonso in Baltimore, saying he's accomplished a lot of the same things without all the noise. You know, one of my regrets is that because we were so intently covering New Orleans and Washington, D.C., we didn't have the resources to go elsewhere and look at what more traditional leaders are doing. But there are a lot of good stories. We've got some New York background noise right now.
That's right. You know that you're in Manhattan. That sounds right. We might have a presidential motorcade come by here in D.C. any minute. So we're used to that. You picked two leaders that did carry a lot of controversy and a lot of attention. And so you just don't know what might have happened if you looked at an Alonso type who's been quieter but effective.
Yeah, I think it, in that sense, we may have done our 1.4 million people watch the NewsHour a bit of a disservice by not showing some traditional people working quietly to make a difference. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated world out there in public education, that's for sure.
Yeah. And in the closing chapter, we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I want to get back to it, is this question of whether we need better people in the classroom or we need to make the teaching job a better job. I mean, somebody could say, look, John, that sounds a little bit like a false dichotomy, right? Can't we do both?
Joel Klein read the book and then wrote a lovely piece in the Wall Street Journal arguing for both. No, I don't think you can do both. I think you need to decide, as I say in the book, that if you figure out a way to value teachers, and teachers, when they're asked what they want to do, they want to be able to collaborate, they want to develop curriculum, they want their evaluations to count at least as much as a bubble test. If you start doing those things, I think what I suggest in the book is that we'll find that we have actually had a lot of better people there all the while, that we'll free up the talent and re-motivate the men and women who went into teaching because they wanted to make a difference. And so I don't think you can, I think you have to choose. And I think the better people argument suggests we'll have a churn. We already have a churn. You know, we lose at least 40% of first year teachers in the first 5 years. The world is full of former teachers. If we could, we don't have a teacher shortage. We have a real leak in the pool. If you could seal up that leak and make teaching a better job. And that doesn't mean more money, even though teachers today make less money than they did, say, 30 years ago, when you correct for inflation. If you could make teaching a better job, I think we would take a big step forward. But as I argue in the book, you also have to acknowledge how the world has changed. May I say one thing about the book, Mike?
Yes, please.
That is that it's only available on Amazon. It's not available in bookstores. We published on Amazon because my company gets 55% of the sale price instead of the usual 15%. I donated the royalties to my nonprofit. So you have to go to Amazon to buy The Influence of Teachers. You're probably going to say that anyway.
Well, I'm glad you got that in there. Well, let me ask you one last question, John, and that's, of course, what happens next? Are you working on another book, or is there, on the NewsHour front, some compelling story that you haven't told yet that you're excited about telling?
Yes to both questions. We have a piece coming up on LIFO, Last In, First Out. We're working on a piece about reading, about early reading. My own sense is that most first graders can learn to read, as I argue in The Influence of Teachers. I am working on another book, perhaps foolishly. The tentative title is A 12-Step Program for Public Education, and playing off the AA approach to changing the world. The problem is I've got about 18 steps, and so that's one of the problems.
Sounds compelling. Can you tell us what you think the public education system is addicted to in that model?
Well, yeah, it's addicted. That's a great question. It is, unfortunately, addicted to mediocrity. Mm-hmm. And the first step is to admit we have a problem.
Yeah.
I don't know all the AA steps, but I know the first step is admit the problem. But that means you have to define the problem. It's a fun thing to play with. Yeah. And maybe folks who watch this will send me their 12 steps. As I say, I've got about 18. Addiction to mediocrity is a real issue.
Okay, great. Well, yep. We'll look forward to that one. And we appreciate your time today. Again, John Merrow, the author of The Influence of Teachers, and of course, correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kanstrom. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.